I'm Emma Pickett.
And I'm a lactation consultant from London. When I first started calling myself Makes Milk, that was my superpower at the time because I was breastfeeding my own two children. And now I'm helping families on their journey. I want your feeding journey to work for you from the very beginning to the very end. And I'm big on making sure parents get support at the end too. Join me for conversations on how breastfeeding is amazing and also sometimes really, really hard. We'll look honestly and openly at that process of making milk. And of course, breastfeeding and chest feeding are a lot more than just making milk. Thank you very much for joining me for today's episode. I'm with the lovely BJ Woodstein, who's an author, academic, translator, doula, IBCLC, and lots of other things besides. She lives with her wife, Fee, and their two children in Norfolk. And she's the author of We're Here, A Practical Guide to Becoming an LGBTQ plus Parent, published by Proclarus Press. I can't say that word, but I'll try and say that word. In this conversation, we're going to be talking about breastfeeding, chest feeding, and infant feeding for queer families. And we've only got an hour. We're not going to pretend to be able to describe a universal experience. Obviously, you can do PhDs in this subject, let alone try and cover it in an hour. We've got lots of different families we're talking about. Every family's different, but hopefully we're going to share some information that will be useful for families and those that support them. Thank you very much for joining me today, BJ.
Thank you for having me, Emma.
So can I just start with a language check? I've heard you speak at the ABM conference and I've read your work and I know that queer is a word that you embrace yourself. Are you okay with me using that word? Is there anything you'd like to say about that word queer or language generally before we get started?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of LGBTQ people don't like the word, so I appreciate that you have checked to see what I'm comfortable with. I really like the word queer for myself for a couple of reasons. One is that it has been used in such a pejorative sense before, so I like that I'm reclaiming it and using it in a positive way for myself. I also like that it's really inclusive. It's kind of this overall umbrella term. Instead of having to choose something that maybe doesn't feel quite right, like maybe lesbian or bisexual or whatever it might be, I can say queer because it covers quite a lot of aspects of my personality and my life.
Yeah, the sort of LGBTQ plus, where's there's a plus stop? Which letters do you include? You know, yeah. it seems like, you know, if you don't use some letters, other people are going to feel discounted. Are you saying bisexual, pansexual? So I'm happy to use that word if you are too. Great. Let's move forward with that.
Yes, thank you.
So it is actually, as I said in the introduction, very hard to make any generalizations about what queer families might experience, as there's obviously a huge range of how families are made and people's biology and people's choices. Tell us about why you wanted to write your book, We're Here.
It's the book that I wish had existed when my wife and I were thinking about starting our family. There was so little information available about what our options were. And I also was aware that living here in the UK, our options were different than, say, somebody living in Italy or someone living in the US. And again, they were different depending on what region you lived in the UK. So I wanted to kind of demystify things for other queer individuals and families and say, here is kind of your one-stop package. All the options listed here, to the best of my ability, with some stories from families about how they did it and why they made those decisions, with my hoping that this will kind of guide you on your way. I wished somebody had said to me and Fee, okay, well, you know, as a two-woman household, you can do X, you can do Y, you can do Z. Here are the pros and cons of each of those approaches when it comes to making your family. And that's kind of was the impetus for the book.
Yep. So one thing I'm just going to state for the record is I think we sometimes as a society slip into assumptions that we can ask queer families about how they had their children and, you know, they don't get privacy by default because everyone says, oh, how, you know, sperm donor, did you know the donor, blah, 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 how did you pick? Yeah. You know, you get asked all those questions. So I'm not going to ask you a single question about your choice and your choice with Fee. But let's talk hypothetically about a lesbian couple in the UK. Let's say they're both cisgender female. They want to start their family. What are their options in the UK? What are sort of people's common choices?
Yes, thanks so much, Emma, as well, for not asking, because I often feel like people do assume that we are going to be the case and we'll tell everything about our lives. And I kind of feel like actually it's our children's stories to share if they choose to. So if you were hypothetically a cisgender two-woman household, you have lots of options. Of course, you could foster or adopt. You could have a known donor. So that's where it's a friend or a relative who donates sperm to you. And if it's a relative, you usually would implant the sperm in somebody who is not related to that person. So, you know, it's the brother of person A and it goes into person B for very obvious reasons. If it's a friend, you, and also if it's a relative, you kind of need to work out a contract in advance saying what your expectations are in terms of contact, what kind of relationship, are there going to be sleepover visits, is the child going to know? Lots of details to sort out there. You can also go for an unknown donor, but even within that, you have your options. You could go to your local fertility clinic and they will give you only a few choices. So you fill in a form, you might say, my spouse has black hair, I would like the sperm donor to have black hair, and they'll search through their database and find maybe three for you to choose from. Or you can equally go to a fertility clinic or stay at home and you can order sperm from one of the sperm banks abroad. Most commonly in the UK, people go to Denmark because there's a really big sperm bank in Copenhagen. And you can have that shipped to your clinic or to your home if you want to do at-home insemination. There's also a really big sperm bank in California that you can choose from. And if you do that, you can then, there are options within options, you can also pay extra and choose somebody who's willing to be contacted when the child, the hypothetical child, turns 18. So within all of these options, you kind of have to have this big conversation about what are we looking for here? Does biology matter to us? How much does it matter? You know, so do you want it to be like a brother who donates the sperm? If it's going to be someone we know, what kind of contact are we looking for? If it's somebody that is an unknown sperm donor, are we hoping that our child could one day have contact, or does that not matter to us? So a lot of conversations that you need to have while deciding.
Yeah. And I know that obviously there are going to be times when couples are going to face discrimination, particularly, you know, trans and non-binary families are going through a lot of difficult times in the UK at the moment. What are some of the, I don't want to dwell on the negative because this is a story about lactation and families being created positively, but I think it's important to highlight discrimination is out there. What are some of the discrimination that families that you spoke to have faced within the UK, particularly trans and non-binary families?
The very first thing I would say is that it is still a postcode lottery. So depending on where you live, you will get different kinds of treatment. And trans and non-binary people I've spoken to in particular have mentioned GPs not being supportive, not being willing to then refer them on. And the thing is that if you don't have the money yourself to pay for fertility treatment, you need to go through your GP and get referred for the NHS. And that partially depends on where you live. It also partially depends on your GP and what they're willing to say. Many GPs will say you have to have been trying to make a baby at home for 6 months or 12 months before we'll refer you. But in certain situations, that's simply not possible. If you're taking hormones, for example, and that maybe affects your eggs or your sperm, depending on what organs you've got. Or if, you know, for example, in the case of two women, you can try all you like at home and you're not going to produce a baby. So there's that kind of gatekeeping discrimination. Then you have the case of going to a clinic and they're there to make money. So they're thinking about, okay, well, how likely is this person going to get pregnant? And they might encourage people to change hormone dosages. They might not want to deal with a certain clinic. Somebody I spoke to said that they were a queer couple. I won't give more details than that. And they went and the clinician said to them, I don't like you people, but we have to accept your pink pound. You know, that was actually said to them. So then you're kind of dealing with that and people's own prejudices, their own biases, their own desire to make money and wanting to have really good results for the clinic. Also, many people don't understand the specific needs of queer individuals and queer families. So, you know, they might say that you need to lose weight, or they might say you need to be off your hormones. And that can really cause a lot of issues for people in terms of mental health, too. So all sorts of kind of gatekeeping issues, I would say, really. Oh, and one other thing is that many clinics are very careful to do lots of blood testing. So, for example, when my wife and I went, even though I was going to be caring, they insisted that my wife get blood tests to show that she didn't have HIV, that she didn't have other conditions, because they felt a child couldn't come into a home like that. And that is something that happens to a lot of LGBTQ plus people. It feels very intrusive and very uncomfortable. Oh, and I've also spoken to people who've noticed on their records that clinics have written, you know, diagnosis same-sex couple or diagnosis trans man. That's not a diagnosis. That's a descriptor. You know, it's not like we're, we're going there with a particular condition that would be maybe a diagnosis, like PCOS. Being queer is not a diagnosis.
Yeah, God. Okay. Huh, okay. I wish I could say that those stories were few and far between, but in 2024, this is still happening. So our focus today is on lactation. That's what we're going to be talking about today, and breastfeeding and chest feeding. So let's go back to the hypothetical cisgender lesbian couple. They are both going to be parents, and some people might be surprised to know that both of them could potentially breastfeed. Even someone who's never lactated, never historically given birth. Can you talk us through what's known as induced lactation, and what are some of the sort of pros and cons, and the couples that you've supported, how do they kind of make the decision about whether induced lactation is right for them? That's a big question.
It's amazing. It's I just find it endlessly fascinating and exciting that actually there are so many options. People often think that if you're queer, your options are sort of closed down. But in the world of lactation, I would say we've got, in some cases, more options than cisgender and straight people, which is really cool. So if in our hypothetical situation, we've got two women and they both want to breastfeed, and let's say they use the terminology breastfeed rather than chest feed or body feed or nurse or something, but just for the sake of the ease of our conversation, we'll say breastfeed for now. The one who is not carrying the baby can go through the protocol. There's a very standardized protocol about taking hormones and starting to try to express milk, ideally using an electric pump because that is more powerful in many cases than a manual pump. And it's something that is usually recommended that you start some months before birth so that your body is starting to get ready. Many people do find it easier to kind of get that going when the baby's here. Because, you know, to be saying, okay, take your hormones and start expressing milk and, you know, your wife is only, you know, 5 months pregnant, it feels very hypothetical. It doesn't feel concrete. And it can feel like, wow, this is a lot of effort to be sitting here, you know, using a pump several times a day when there's no baby who's getting, you know, anything from me. So it's usually recommended you start in advance, but understandably, some people choose to start a little bit later. One of the things that I find very interesting is to think about the ethics of the situation. If you know that one of the two mothers is going to be the primary feeder, then it might make sense in that situation for that person to start kind of exclusively breastfeeding the baby so that her supply is there and so that she gets into a routine. And then you can add in the other mother, especially, as I said, if she's not planning on doing it in a primary fashion. However, if they are planning to share it, or the other mother is the one who intends to be the primary breastfeeder, then you do have to rethink that situation. So it's important for them to talk in advance about what they're planning to do and why. Another related option for them, which is also a form of sharing feeding, is if the one who is not gestating right now has previously given birth. Either she can relactate, which is a lot easier in some ways, if she has stopped lactating, or if she's already feeding a baby or a toddler or young child, she can simply start putting the new baby to her breast as well. And one other thing, we've been talking about kind of induced lactation and relactating, but I've also spoken to people who had kind of spontaneous lactation. So non-induced lactation, where it was kind of this moment of, I didn't gestate the baby, but here's the baby. My hormones have gone crazy. I'm so like thrilled and in love with this baby and my breasts are producing milk. And yeah. Some people have gone with that and encouraged that. And other people have said, that's not really for me. And they've decreased their milk supply and not fed. And so those are some of the choices they have.
Yeah, oxytocin is an amazing thing. Your body just going, woohoo, baby in the house, let's just go for it.
Yeah, and actually, you know, we've heard cases of men spontaneously lactating as well and choosing to feed their baby too. So it's not only for women.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned that hormonal protocol, which I know is the Newman Goldfarb protocol.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, which I is
no, it's okay. You're totally fair enough. We can't go into detail on everything. And in that protocol, people take a hormonal contraceptive pill to sort of mimic the hormones of pregnancy. And then the idea is you stop taking that and then you start taking a drug, which is usually domperidone, which is going to stimulate prolactin hormone. And you do that all the way through while you're expressing breast milk. So one couple I worked with, you know, as a lesbian, she'd never taken birth control. She'd never taken hormonal contraception. The idea of taking the combined contraceptive pill did not feel comfortable. That was just felt very alien to her. And she didn't want to use any hormonal contraception at all. She really just didn't even want to use domperidone, just wanted to use a breast pump. Is that an option? Is that going to be less successful if somebody does that?
I think the research suggests that it generally is slightly less successful, but that doesn't mean it's not an option. And especially, I would say, if you wait until the baby's here and you've got that kind of hormone, natural hormone from seeing your baby, getting to smell their clothes, getting to look at them and... You know, if you're away from them, looking at pictures of them, just like we would advise for anybody, you know, expressing milk, that can work. It's just that it's a little bit easier if you help it along the way with hormones. And I do think, Emma, it's really important for us to mention, you know, our sort of hypothetical example is two women who identify as lesbians and who are cisgender women. But it's also very possible for trans women to go through this protocol. And I worked with a couple where they were two women, one was trans, and it was really important for her. She described as kind of validating of her womanhood to breastfeed. And so she started the protocol some months before and actually really enjoyed the process because it was a way of preparing for their baby's arrival and was able to, you know, produce not a full supply. She was not the primary feeder. And she went back to work relatively quickly after the baby was born. But she was able to produce some milk and to feed the baby at her breast some of the time. And that was really special for her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are always myths flying around on social media. I think one of the myths that's been flying around in the last few weeks and months is that if a parent induces lactation, their milk is somehow going to be inferior, that their galactoseals are going to operate in different ways somehow or be full of hormones. Do we have any evidence to suggest that milk is inferior if someone's induced lactation?
No, I mean, for one thing, okay, there's not been a huge amount of research, but what research we do have has not suggested that in any way. And in fact, people have been using, we'll use the technical term, the Newman-Goldfarb protocol for quite some time. Initially, I think it was developed for adoptive parents, and nobody was ever saying, oh, if you're, you know, an adoptive parent, you know, your milk isn't as good. Nobody was ever saying that. It's only when it relates to queer people that there's this kind of concern. So there's been no research to suggest that. And in fact, it would be really interesting to see somebody research the nutritional quality of milk from different parents and how that milk was produced, because there might be some, you know, we know that your milk is different depending on your baby and kind of how often you're feeding and if your baby's ill. And it would just be fascinating to know if there are any differences.
Yeah. I mean, we know that the volume of milk you produce can control things like your protein content and your sodium content. So I guess there's going to be some variation there. In the same way that people feeding toddlers have go into that kind of weaning milk phase, and as their volume drops, their milk constituents change. But I don't think we'd ever argue that smaller volume is harmful or going to be hurting the baby in any way.
Yeah, that it's not as good and that you shouldn't be, you know, feeding your baby or something like that, no.
Yeah, and it could well mean if there are two parents and one of them is induced lactation, that baby gets to be exclusively human milk fed in a way they may not otherwise. I mean, you talked before about the sort of primary feeder and the secondary feeder if a family are not exactly equally co-feeding. One of the things that I've talked about with couples is the importance of those very early days and having really explicit conversations that you can't necessarily have in advance because you don't know how you're going to feel. So baby blues, for example, or that sort of hormonal rush that comes, you know, day four, day five, you know, you're going to have a wobble, you're going to worry about who you are as a parent, you might worry about your milk production. You know, you need to make sure that you can have really honest conversations with your partner in a way that doesn't leave them feeling like, you know, their milk supply is lesser or less important. You know, we want to make sure that the mum who's given birth is able to develop their milk supply fully. And this is likely to be a family with breast pumps, I'm going to be guessing. It's, you know, we're going to be protecting everyone's supply. We're going to be making sure that, you know, mastitis isn't a risk and blocked ducts aren't going to be a risk. So This is probably a family who's been pumping through the end of pregnancy and then using the pump to protect everybody's breastfeeding, chestfeeding journey once baby's here as well.
Absolutely. The kinds of conversations that you're recommending that people have are so important. And in some cases, it might be useful for them to see an IBCLC before birth, or to, you know, maybe phone the National Breastfeeding Helpline or whatever, you know, they feel they can fit into their schedule and within their means. Because you don't always know the conversations you need to have until, you know, until it's the time. I mean, and actually it relates back to what we were saying before about choosing adoption, known donor, you know, unknown donor, because people don't know how they're going to feel. They might think, hey, it's great to have a known donor. A couple I worked with used the brother of one of them, and they thought it was an excellent plan, a way of keeping it within the family. He would be involved. And then the mother who carried has actually said she's regretted it every single day since, because they see him so often and she didn't want that kind of relationship and she feels she's got less control over the child. But you don't know until you're in the situation how you're going to feel. So maybe having a guided conversation, as I said, with an IBCLC or maybe a counselor. So you're thinking about those kinds of really difficult issues.
Yeah, there's a feeling stuff and there's emotion stuff and there's also the practical lactation stuff. Yes. So everybody, even the heterosexual male female couples, say, wouldn't it be great if, you know, my husband could breastfeed? That would be the dream. But we equally don't want day three, you know, mother who's given birth to be sleeping all night long and her partner to be breastfeeding through the night. Even, you know, let's imagine her partner's had amazingly successful induced lactation, loads of milk, is able to breastfeed a newborn on day three. You know, that whole night of the birth mother not feeding is not plan A. I mean, that is definitely not going to be ideal for, you know, their lactation moving forward and helping their milk come in, etc. So it's also important that lactation consultants having that conversation can feel comfortable having that conversation, and you know, to say that is not dismissing the partner who is inducing lactation or not implying that they are lesser than. It's just about knowing how hormones work, knowing how lactogenesis works, knowing what prolactin needs, and just having the sort of facts so everybody can make a really informed decision.
Yeah.
And I have worked with one couple who thought they were going to do induced lactation and very quickly realized it didn't feel comfortable and the emotions were not what they were expecting post-birth and it didn't last more than a few days, which I think we have to be open to all options and all possibilities.
Absolutely.
And equally, if somebody who's, you know, in a lesbian relationship does not want to induce lactation and is not their bag, you know, that is absolutely their right.
If you have somebody and they don't want to induce lactation, and as you said, that's absolutely their choice, they still can do, you know, nice chest-to-chest, skin-to-skin contact. And that can include the baby suckling on their nipple if that feels comfortable for them as a couple. And I have spoken to people who've done that, you know, like, oh, you know, the one who's breastfeeding is having a shower. Baby is crying. Let's put baby to the breast. Yeah, she's not getting anything out of it, or he's not getting anything out of it. But that doesn't matter. The baby is enjoying that process of suckling. So, you know, that is certainly an option too.
Yes, all options. There's so many different things that people may not realize.
And, you know. We haven't even covered them all yet, Emma.
No. A little advert just to say that you can buy my 4 books online. You've Got It In You, A Positive Guide to Breastfeeding, is 99p as an ebook, and that's aimed at expectant and new parents. The Breast Book, published by Pinter & Martin, is a guide for 9 to 14-year-olds, and it's a puberty book that puts the emphasis on breasts, which I think is very much needed. And my last 2 books are about supporting breastfeeding beyond 6 months and supporting the transition from breastfeeding. For a 10% discount on the last 2, go to Jessica Kingsley Press, that's uk.jkp.com, and use the code MMPE10. Makes milk, pick it, Emma. 10. Thanks. Okay, let's change hypotheticals for a moment. Let's talk about a gay couple who are both cisgender male. They're using surrogacy or adoption to make their family and they want to give their baby human milk. What are the options for them in the UK?
Well, so if they're, let's start with the surrogacy example. They have the option of asking the surrogate whether she would provide milk. So she would then have to express. And I have heard from people who've decided to do that for, say, 6 weeks or for several months. And that is a conversation they have to have. There is usually some sort of remuneration, you're not technically allowed to pay for surrogacy or, you know, somebody producing milk for you or anything like that in the UK, but you are allowed to cover expenses. And so if somebody is expressing milk for you, there's a way that you can call, you know, because it's labor, we know it's labor. So then you can cover their labor expenses, any, you know, the pump they have to buy, you know, breast milk bags or, you know, whatever it might be. But that's a conversation. Not all surrogates would be willing to do that. So if that's not an option for you, you can go and get donor milk. Now, we know that there are both formal and informal networks in the UK for donor milk. And we, I think, as IBCLCs, would always be really cautious about the informal networks of milk. And I have to say, personally, I've donated milk informally, so I'm quite familiar with that world. But whether somebody wants to take a chance on it, that really has to be their choice. And you have to feel that you can trust the person. You know, if the person says, you know, I eat such and such and I take these supplements and I don't drink and I don't do drugs, you know, can you trust them? How well do you know them? So that is a choice to get the milk informally or to go to a formal milk bank, which isn't always easy, even though there's been an increase to, I think, how much people are donating to milk banks in the UK in recent years. I mean, I think that has been something that's been really exciting to see. My understanding is that they try to keep it for premature babies, babies with certain needs. And so it may be a little bit harder for that gay male couple to access milk in that way.
Yeah. So the Hearts Milk Bank is one of the milk banks in the UK that historically has given milk to the community. And the charity Human Milk Foundation was set up to enable that to happen because people don't get, you know, you never pay for human milk as a family in the community. And that community provision just kind of comes and goes depending on what milk's available and we know what's going on with the organisation. And it isn't necessarily straightforward, but there's never any harm in asking. There's never any harm in seeing what the capacity is and having that conversation. And there is milk that is donated that isn't suitable for premature babies, but could go to full-term babies, which is going to be the situation here. So it's always worth having that conversation. You mentioned, you know, knowing a donor is great. If you do have that trusting relationship with your informal donor, that, you know, there's going to be an element of trust there already. One of the things that I was talking about with Gillian Weaver, who's one of the co-founders of Hearts Milk Bank, is you can actually ask for blood testing as well. It's very something rarely that happens in an informal donor situation, but, you know, the same blood tests that are done for formal donors, you could have those blood tests done for informal donors as well if that was something you're worried about. You can also pasteurize milk in a home setting. There are guidance for doing that online. You know, I'm an IBCLC too, and that's not something we can necessarily advocate people do, but if people inform themselves about the risks, that's definitely an option. You mentioned that surrogacy is different in the UK compared to the US. It does seem to be on Instagram. The gay couples who are traveling around with human milk in insulated bags, you know, they seem to have, you know, a lot of human milk flying around. It looks like it's easier for couples to access. Is that because of the surrogacy agreement being different? So the rules in the UK are you can't pay somebody to be a surrogate. Presumably that means that the surrogacy situation in the UK is very different and very much smaller. And in the US, how is it different?
Well, so I am not an expert on it, but my understanding is that you can hire somebody in another country as well. And then it does cost a lot more because you are treating it, I think, as employment. But some other countries have started saying, no, they don't want it to be done like that because they're understandably worried that women are being taken advantage of. But one of the things that I would say about the United States is, as we know, it's very much a pumping culture. So that has pros and cons in and of itself. But it means that for some people wanting to access pumped human milk, potentially in the informal system, it can be a lot easier. I mean, I don't know if you must have read Trevor McDonald's book. And in it, he, you know, talks about the kind of experience of going all over Canada, basically, or all over certain regions of Canada, looking for donor milk to feed his baby and the kind of generosity of people. And I think that is because it's so much more common to pump and to build up your kind of milk stash that it feels easier than to kind of provide that for other people.
Yeah. And I guess if you are using a surrogate in the States who's an American surrogate who perhaps has already given birth herself to her own children, she's probably much more comfortable with pumping. And, you know, people are pumping going back to work at like 3 or 4 weeks, whereas in the UK, it's just like going to be less familiar. Maybe, yeah, that's a good point. Mentioning Trevor, I know that when Trevor McDonald was chest feeding his own child, he used an SNS or a supplementary nutritional system. And that's not something that all trans dads may feel comfortable doing. And there's obviously a whole range of different experiences here. And we're not implying that a trans dad should chest feed, but that was Trevor's choice. And Trevor went on to become a lecture league leader in Canada. Can you talk us through what an SNS is and how it works and what the options are for chest feeding?
The SNS is something that I guess we could, in simplest terms, since we're talking rather than being seen, it could be described as a tube that you can tape or attach to your chest or your breast, depending on how you refer to that area. And it has a bag or a container where you put the milk. And some people do put formula in there, but you can also put, your own milk if you would rather not. If you want to express and feed that way, you can put donor milk, you can put your partner's milk, you can put some other milk in there, and then you can feed the baby at your chest. And I mean, actually, it's something that is relevant to non-queer people as well. Somebody that I was supporting who was a straight woman, she needed to use that because her milk supply was rather low. So she was using formula in there, but she put her baby at her breast because she was using it as a way of stimulating her own milk supply. So it can work in other situations too. So if you wanted to use that, it's often for the experience of feeding at the chest or the breast. And it's if you perhaps feel that your milk supply is low, if we're going to be very explicit, I suppose some trans men have had chest surgery. And this is a whole issue in and of itself that not all trans men are warned or given accurate information by their doctors before chest surgery about how it could impact their breastfeeding or chest feeding journey later on. And also I've spoken to some trans men who said, even if I had been told that, I wouldn't have cared because I just really wanted the breast tissue gone. So in those cases, sometimes they realize, actually, I want to feed my baby at my chest, but I'm not able to produce the supply or I don't have enough, of the mammary tissue. And so this is a way of making it work for them.
In pregnancy, do trans dads have more breast tissue or chest tissue developing because of pregnancy hormones? I'm guessing if there are people who've had top surgery who then find new growth. I mean, is that a common experience?
Yes, from what my understanding is, I'm not sure it's universal, but I think it's certainly common. I think it does depend on the kind of surgery you've had, how much has been removed. And the issue or an issue there is that it can lead to increased feelings of gender dysphoria. Which is understandable because if you are a man and suddenly you are developing breasts or developing breasts for the second time in your life, that can feel really upsetting because, in our society, even though people joke about man boobs or things like that, we generally think of breasts as being something for women. And so if it's something for women, why is that happening to your body when you're a man? So that can cause issues and depression. As I said, increased gender dysphoria, concerns about body and being seen as the man that you are. So it is challenging. And related to that, some men use a binder, a chest binder, to kind of keep that tissue down. And especially if they're finding that it's growing. But that is a little bit tricky because, we've already spoken about mastitis. You don't want to do anything to be kind of compressing the tissue and causing additional problems in that area. So if somebody came to you and said, oh, I want to use a chest binder again now that I've given birth, but I'm also chest feeding, you might want to have a conversation about, okay, what material are you using for that chest binder? How tight are you keeping it? How many hours a day are you ensuring that you're not, squeezing that tissue so much that you are going to get blocked ducts?
Yeah, and obviously talking about symptoms of mastitis and, potentially could get very, very unwell and also reducing milk supply because that compression, the body mistakes that as messages of engorgement and milk supply will be reduced as well. I guess one of the things we said before is that people aren't necessarily going to know how they feel until they're in that moment.
No.
And I can't remember what Trevor McDonald said in his book about his pregnancy experience. Did he always know that he wanted to chest feed? Do you remember the details?
I can't remember that either. But I think that, as you say, sometimes you think it's not relevant to your life. And then suddenly you find, actually, this is something that matters to me. And certainly, when I think about the people I interviewed to write my own book, you know, there were feelings all across the spectrum. There are people who were adamant that they did not want anybody touching that part of their body. And then the baby was born and they thought, well, I'll give it a go. And actually, I quite like this. Or in some cases, well, I don't really like it, but I want to keep doing it because it feels like a way to build our bond or it feels right. And then there were people who said, I'm not going to do it. And they didn't do it. And that was right for them, too. So I think it's really, really hard to predict how you're going to feel about things in advance of them, especially when you've got all the different kind of hormones and emotions in play.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously the element of gender dysphoria, you know, on top of everything. I think one thing, just from what you just said, I just was reminded that some people who are not trans, not non-binary, don't necessarily love breastfeeding. They, you know, no. Not everybody who feeds their children at their breast loves it. Some people are doing it because they know it's the right thing and it's a choice that they want to make, but they don't love every moment of it. And, you know, I was talking to someone the other day who was weaning at sort of 18 months and I'd supported them. And they said to me at the end, oh God, I'm so relieved that's done. I'm not sure I enjoyed a minute of that. I just felt my intellectual brain told me that's what I needed to do. And I was like, wow, okay. That wasn't something she'd expressed to me at the beginning. So I kind of had to reflect on that and why I hadn't given her the space to be able to do that. But not everybody loves feeding their children.
No, absolutely not. And I think lots of people have a kind of, I don't want to say love-hate relationship with it, but, you know, moments of really enjoying it, moments of, why am I doing this? This is horrible. This is hard. Or, you know, feeling like it makes them, you know, their skin crawl or, you know, so especially at different points in your cycle too, you can feel differently. And as you say, we need to kind of give people the space to express all that and not be judgmental about how they're feeling in regard to their breastfeeding or chest feeding experience.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment to people who are breastfeeding or chest feeding supporters, people who are in the kind of lactation support world. If somebody's running a drop-in group and they haven't historically been very queer supportive or queer friendly, what are some of the things that you would want them to think about? What are some of the things that you think are most important?
I mean, to start with, you could think about how you advertise your group. So are you calling it the Mums and Babies Breastfeeding Group? Or are you saying, you know, this is a lactation support group or a breastfeeding and chest feeding group or, you know, some other kind of inclusive terminology? Some people are really uncomfortable with inclusive terminology because they think that it means we're saying you can't use the word that fits you best. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying add. It's additive. So you could say breastfeeding and chest feeding. You could say mums and dads, or you could just say parents. So that would be a place to start, is making it clear that you are open to everybody. And you could say that in whatever publicity material you've got. You know, this is a lactation group for all parents at all stages of their feeding journey. That would be the first thing. Another thing would be, you know, if you wear lanyards or name tags or you just do introductions, really thinking about whether you could offer your own pronouns. Sometimes people say, well, you know, my pronoun is so obvious. Why should I have to say it? And it's like, well, it's not really for your benefit. It's for other people's benefit so that they feel comfortable saying that I'd rather you call me they, or I look this way, but my pronoun is actually this, or, you know, so maybe making space for, hi, my name is such and such. My pronouns are, you know, whatever. Welcome to our group. What about you? You know, doing things like that. And also thinking about the way you talk about people, but not making assumptions about who you're seeing. So if, let's say, two women walked in, not saying, oh, how nice that you've brought your baby and your sister, you know, not making those kinds of, which
yes.
happens a lot.
Yeah. Or your sis, how lovely your sister's with you. And oh, your sister seems to be there at 2 o'clock in the morning every day. That's interesting. And how does your sister know all those details about birth, your birth? Oh, your mother was another one that I heard someone say
yes,
that their partner was called their mother.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, a week ago I was talking to somebody and she was saying, yes, my wife is, you know, 7 or 8 years older than me, but she doesn't look like my mother. And people are always assuming we're mother-daughter just because of the age gap. So, yeah, not making assumptions and asking people. So
I know I was sort of making light of that in a moment ago, but it's just, you know, the particular person told me the story was kind of laughing about it, but it is not going to be funny at the most vulnerable time in your life when you are walking in the door and you've immediately got a barrier to overcome and then you've got to have a conversation you didn't want to have. You've got, it's just, you know, we sort of joke about it, but it is just a grim experience. You're othered the second you walk in the door.
I mean, I would say that, you know, as queer people, we are used to that happening a lot and we're used to having to explain ourselves. But as you say, it's a very vulnerable time. If you do find, if you're, you know, a breastfeeding, chest feeding supporter, and you find that you do make a mistake with pronouns or assumptions or whatever it is, it's really easy to just say sorry. And I think people kind of work themselves up and go, I didn't mean, I didn't think, and just sorry. That's all you have to say. Sorry, I'll get it right next time. And it doesn't have to be this overwrought thing.
Yeah, and centering yourself in the apology is something that unfortunately we still see. I mean, my son, who is not trans, not non-binary, had long hair when he was younger, and I remember somebody misgendering him, and I said, actually, not a problem, but it's actually a he. And she burst into tears, and I had to spend I had to spend 10 minutes comforting her.
Oh my gosh, I shouldn't laugh at that either,
but and I mean, there was probably something going on for her there. I wasn't aware what it was, but that I do often see that frantic over apology where people are just repeatedly saying, "Oh my god, I'm so desperately sorry, please forgive me." It's like, hang on, this is not about you. Just a simple apology and moving on.
Yeah, and thinking about how to do better next time. I mean, I'm thinking of a time that somebody, I happened to mention my partner, and somebody said, oh, and he did it. And I said, oh, actually, it's a woman. And he said, sorry, I don't know why I made that assumption. Anyway, so she, and it was really simple, and we just moved on, and I really appreciated that. So as you say, just kind of doing it, not making it about yourself, and then making sure that you get it right the next time.
Have you seen some examples of really good resources or groups really sort of going out of their way? Is anybody you want to kind of give a shout out to?
Oh, I kind of wish that I could. I mean, I've seen kind of some individuals who've said that, you know, I mean, IBCLCs and other people who've said, you know, look, I support everybody. I've spoken to people who feel that certain areas are more open. The obvious example being like Brighton or Hebden Bridge, where there are a lot more queer people. But I have not seen like major examples of good practice. I don't know. Have you seen any that you think are brilliant?
I mean, we could have a whole other conversation around where we are in the lactation space with inclusive language. There's a lot of very passionate people who are really struggling with inclusive language and are very worried and frightened. And also some people who are desperately saying, I'm here. Please don't ignore me. Please don't dismiss me. You know, and I've historically, you know, written books that have been completely non-inclusive and didn't even realize it was an issue. And I think everyone's got to do better. And we've all as lactation professionals, we've always centered the people we've worked with. We've always adapted our language. You know, when a mum has said boob, we've said boob. When a, you know, we've always done that.
Yes.
But I think we've got this sort of transphobia, homophobia now twisting up in it that means that we feel as if if we stop doing that, we're somehow supporting women by not doing that. And, you know, and it's a very difficult space to have conversations in. And there's, you know, I'm not going to pretend I have all the answers, and there are other people who are more knowledgeable about this than me. But I think we do have to try and understand that there are people out there who are non-binary, who are trans, who are wanting to feed their babies. And if we are telling them you're not welcome in this space, babies don't get milk. It's as simple as that. And, you know, and babies are the ones that will be suffering at the end of the day. So I wish I had an answer to how we can get to a place where everybody feels comfortable, but we're definitely not there yet.
We're not there. But I mean, trying to educate yourself, because, you know, we all can be better allies to different groups of people in many different ways. And so that is, you know, we're human, we make mistakes, but we also keep growing and keep developing. And as long as we're open to new knowledge, then, you know, we're trying the best we can. I mean, in my role as a doula, I was at a birth with a non-binary client, and the midwife who was actually said to me, I'm old fashioned, I don't understand this kind of language, I'm just going to say she. And I was saying, no. My client is they. Can we please use the appropriate language? And my client was obviously getting kind of upset because, as you know, you're vulnerable and it's a very difficult situation in some ways. And so to have somebody continually misgender you. And in the end, we had to say, actually, this midwife can't be here. And if you cannot respect the person that you are here to serve, then please, could you go work with a different client and we'll have a different midwife? We had a different midwife who was great, who said they, and, you know, it was fine. So if you feel as a supporter or an IBCLC that you are not the right person to work with this client, and I'm hoping you wouldn't feel that way, but if it turned out that that was the case, it's better to remove yourself from that situation, you know, to say, actually, I don't know very much about da, da, da. However, my colleague so-and-so does, and so I'm going to send them in. You know, I mean, I think sometimes removing yourself from the situation is the best thing that you can do. Unfortunately, as you say, because we're not there yet with everybody feeling comfortable with everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. I think what you said about how, you know, being an ally isn't a journey you finish. You don't do a course, you don't tick a box, you're not sorted out. You know, it's always going to be ongoing, and people are still going to make mistakes and people are still going to say the wrong thing. But it's really about what you do when someone is in front of you and how you speak and treat that person with respect. And I'm hoping everybody who's listened to this, who's got this far, is whatever they're saying, you know, on their social media, when they're in front of somebody, I would hope everybody will be supporting an individual. But as you say, there are some people who maybe need to step away from a situation so everybody can feel safe. And when parents are giving birth and in the early stages of lactation, it's the most vulnerable time in someone's life. You know, yes. The idea of having to deal with discrimination on top of that is just, you know, it's going to affect outcomes. It's going to affect your physicality. It's going to affect your ability to give birth. It's going to stop your oxytocin happening. I mean, just that client you're talking about there who was constantly being, you know, misgendered, that's possibly going to mean they're more likely to, you know, have to have an intervention in their birth because their levels, yes, their stress hormones are going to increase. So it's just, these are not just words. These are serious things.
They are very serious. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry, stating the obvious.
No, it's very important. And, you know, we need to respect people as individuals, and we're not all the same. And that's what's, you know, amazing about getting to know other people. But it's also a problem that we're not all the same, and that, you know, we think about how we would want a certain situation. And it's usually not what works for somebody else.
Yeah. And milk production is also about oxytocin, and that oxytocin hormone needs us to feel relaxed and supported and calm. And, you know, we're not going to be getting the milk ejection reflex if we're sitting in front of somebody who is, you know, not respecting our partner or, you know, making jokes or asking intrusive questions. And I think also, you know, what we touched on earlier, I think sometimes allies can be overly enthusiastic sometimes. And I think that's not often talked about because we're busy focusing on the very negative stereotypes. But I think sometimes when someone is really over the top, oh my God, it's fantastic that you're lesbian. Yeah. It's brilliant. My cousin's a lesbian and this is how they're going to have a child. And
do you know them? Yeah, people say
brilliant.
That.
Oh, I'm so happy to work with you. And, you know, you know, can I take your details and can you be on my podcast? And I think you're fantastic. You know, there's an extreme version which can lead to intrusive questions. And also,
absolutely.
We're just a couple having a baby. Chill, lady.
No, but people sometimes do think it's so exciting. And actually, one of the books that I translated most recently, which is about a trans boy, he talks about how his aunt is one of these really positive, like, I'm so proud of you doing you. And isn't it wonderful that your parents accept you? And he's kind of like, well, no, they're just being, you know, parents as you would hope parents would be. And I'm just being me. And, you know, and he finds it really annoying how over the top she is. And so, yeah, people do kind of have to watch out for that kind of over-enthusiastic allyship as well.
Yeah, well, hopefully one day we'll get to a stage where it's all very ordinary and boring and normal and discrimination goes away. And that's where we're going to be in a few hundred years. Let's dream and imagine.
We can definitely dream. Can we mention one thing that I think isn't often talked about in relation to queer people and lactation? And that's actually the workplace. And, you know, one of my other roles is that I do consulting in equality, diversity and inclusion. And I work a lot with different companies and institutions. And I've been asked, what can a workplace do to support queer people and lactation? And I think that's a really, really good question that I hope more people would think about, because we often see, you know, breastfeeding rooms or, you know, breastfeeding space. And, you know, it would be a pretty simple thing to change terminology and talk about, this is the lactation and expressing room, or this is the breastfeeding, chest feeding and expressing room, or, you know, whatever. And also to ensure that you're able, your HR person or manager or whoever is in charge of these things, talks to each individual who's going off on parental leave and asks them, what will be your needs when you come back? You know, and some trans men will not, you know, they will not be open as trans men. And it may be an uncomfortable conversation to have to disclose that information to say, well, I plan to be continuing my expressing when I return or something. But ensuring that there is space for that conversation, and also a private physical space where people can go to feed or to express. And of course, a little fridge to store the milk. I think those things are really essential as well. I just wanted to get that in there because I feel like people often forget about the bit when you go back to work as a queer person.
Yeah, no, thank you for highlighting that. Yeah, that's definitely important. I think the UK has got quite a long way to go when it comes to supporting lactation in the workplace. But if you feel you've got extra barriers on top of that, that's not going to be comfortable. Are there particular workplaces that you think are worth celebrating in the UK that you've worked with or had knowledge of?
No, I mean, that's, I think, why I'm needed to do this kind of work at the moment, because it's something people haven't thought about. They often act like they're doing you a big favor, like, oh, well, you know, you can go into the bathroom, you can go into the disabled toilet or something, which is problematic for all sorts of reasons. Or they say, like one place that an institution, a large institution, they had one room in all their buildings, just one room for everybody. And it was like, they just called it the breastfeeding and resting room. So if you were ill, you could also go to that room.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we really want people with influenza to be lying next to people expressing their breast milk. That's an awesome
idea. And, one key, and you had to go ask someone for the key. So, you know, we still definitely have quite far to go in terms of making things more lactation friendly at workplaces.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for highlighting that, BJ. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you think is important to mention, or any other resources that you would recommend people go to? Are there any directories where people can find sort of birth workers and lactation supporters who are particularly queer friendly?
I'm not aware of one, actually. I don't know. Are you aware of one? Because it would be really interesting to know.
I'm not, which is probably my failure, because I believe there must be. So I'm going to do some research and see what I can find, and maybe there'll be some names we can put in the show notes, or directory names we can put in the show notes. I'm sure it does exist, because we will not be the first people to have realised this, especially at the moment. We need to make sure that we're talking to safe people.
There are some people who do a lot of that, partially because of who they are or by dint of where they live, like Zoe and Brighton, who works a lot with LGBTQ people, and Stephanie in New York City, another IBCLC who does a lot with LGBTQ people. Or maybe she's moved to Hawaii now. But anyway, you know, there are a couple of people who I know are kind of like specialists in it, but I don't know of a directory, and it would be great for us to have one. Because, you know, if you are thinking about hiring a lactation consultant, or for example, in the case of, you know, me as a doula as well, it really helps to know that, okay, this person has worked with other people like me, maybe has a bit of, you know, cultural, ethical knowledge about my group of people, and is going to be able to support me to the best of their ability. Versus this kind of unknown, well, I'm just going to, you know, contact someone randomly and see if they've ever worked with a trans woman before, you know, and that you don't necessarily want to be their first kind of test case, or you don't know what kind of response you're going to get from them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the world of Instagram, if you're a queer expectant parent, you will probably be following queer doulas. You probably will know people who are out there that are in your community, but you know, not everybody should be reinventing the wheel. Sharon Silberstein is a doctor in North London who works a lot with induced lactation couples, and you know, prescribes domperidone, and I know she's got a lot of experience in this space. But yeah, we need to. I'll see what else I can find to put in the show notes. Thank you very much for your time today, BJ. Really appreciate it. I know we've just grazed the surface, and there'll be some people listening to this thinking, oh my God, you didn't even talk about XYZ. Why didn't you talk about that? And if something really was missing, you know, this is a conversation that can happen again. It's not like there's one episode on queer people,
no.
Tick, we're done, we're sorted. I'm sure there are more stories to tell, and that might include stories from families and couples as well. But thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma.
Thank you for joining me today. You can find me on Instagram at Emma Pickett IBCLC and on Twitter at Makes Milk. It would be lovely if you subscribed, because that helps other people to know I exist, and leaving a review would be great as well. Get in touch if you would like to join me to share your feeding or weaning journey, or if you have any ideas for topics to include in the podcast. This podcast is produced by the lovely Emily Crosby Media.